Good morning. Yesterday, I described ordinary differential equations, and after giving a brief example for how you can solve ODEs, I pointed to a package that you can use, and I mentioned that for partial differential equations, things are a bit more complicated. So I'm going to spend two or three lectures on ways to solve partial differential equations, starting today. And the main idea when you solve a partial differential equation is that the solution of the PDE is not some numbers, it's actually a function. You're looking for a function. And that is, we need to find out how to represent a function in a constructive way in a Julia code. We know how to represent numbers, right? Floating point numbers, but how can we represent a function? And when you solve an ODE, you kind of get the solution at a few points, but that's not really satisfying. We actually want to represent functions, and I'm going to spend a bit of time describing that, first on a blackboard, and then going through some examples in a Julia notebook. So let's assume we have a function that we want to represent, let's say f, and I'll just start 1D, but in the end, it can go any number of dimensions. If a function f of x, and we want to represent it, and then since I'm a physicist, I'm allowed to assume that f is analytic, and then I can expand it in a set of basis functions. Countably, infinite basis functions need to be enough. So we go from I equals 0 to infinity. There are going to be some coefficients ci and some basis function bi of x. And every analytic function can be written like that, and if functions are not analytic, something similar is probably going to work. And every non-analytic function has an analytic function living nearby. That's usually good enough. And what we do numerically, of course, let's call this f star, because this is the true solution. We are going to write a function as, we're just introducing some cut of n. Instead of going to infinity, we just use n number of basis function, ci, bi, what, that's not a good I, of x, and that's then an approximation of the actual analytic function. Sometimes you call it fn. And you probably have seen that in various places when you solve something. So let's give some example. The basis functions that you choose depend on your domain and your setup. And here you have the basis functions. So you're probably familiar with spherical harmonics. So if your domain is the surface of a sphere, let's call it S2, then a good set of basis functions are YLM spherical harmonics. And they're particularly convenient because they are not just the basis, but they're also orthogonal. And actually having an orthogonal set of basis functions is really convenient. So today, I will concentrate on basis functions that are orthogonal. Not necessarily orthonormal, depending on what norm you choose, the basis functions might not actually integrate to one. And if you have a domain that goes, say, from minus 1 to plus 1, what kind of basis function would you choose there? One good set of basis functions are the Legendre polynomials. Have you heard of these? They're usually called PL. And another good set of basis functions for that particular domain are the Chebyshev functions. They're usually called TN. And if your domain is, say, from 0 to 2 pi, and the domain is actually periodic, what kind of basis functions would you choose then?
Sines and cosines.
Sine and cosine, very good, yes. So cosine, let me just write the basis function in. I think it's cosine kx and sine kx, and actually for the cosine, we let k equal be 0, and for the sine, we want k to be strictly positive. And that means if we have k equals 0, then the cosine for k equals 0 is just a constant function. It's kind of the one of the simplest functions. But if we put k equals 0 in the sine function, it would be all 0. That can't be a basis function because it's 0. And if you, I mean, these are two sets of basis functions. You need both of them to represent things. It's kind of a two-parameter family. If you're willing to deal with complex numbers, then you can more easily write e to the I kx, and that includes both. That is usually easier. But then you pick up complex numbers. It's up to you whether you like that. Of course, even if your basis functions are complex, you can still take a real function and expand it in a set of complex basis functions. You're going to add complex coefficients, but the function is going to stay real, so nothing goes wrong there. It's just there some additional condition. I don't know, some of these coefficients are the complex conjugate or something else or so, and then the number of degrees of freedoms work out. When we talk about a vector space that we have here, then it's usually very nice if you have a dot product in that vector space, and we're going to need that. So the dot products, for example, for S2, you all know that. Say you have a function f and a function g, and you define a dot product, then it's of course just the integral over the sphere, right? Integral f of theta and phi, g, theta and phi, sine theta d omega or something. And some people put a factor in front of it, 1 over 4 pi, others don't. And y0, 0 function is sometimes defined to be 1. And sometimes you put a factor 1 over square root of 4 pi in there, and so on and so forth. There are many different conventions when it comes to normalizations, and if complex numbers are involved, also for phase factors. So you need to be important. If you say I expand something into spherical harmonics, that doesn't help. Mathematica probably uses one convention. Wikipedia might use the same convention as Mathematica, but whatever Jackson uses in electrodynamics and whatever astronomers use for their cosmic microwave background and so on, they just might make different conventions, different phase factors, different normalization factors. So you need to be really careful and dig into the details. And if you find a nice Julia package that is called sphericalharmonics.jl, you don't know what basis functions, sorry, what phase factors or normalization factors they use. So you need to look at the details and make sure that it all works. And it's easy to test that. You just calculate some integrals, and then you see whether the base factor is, sorry, the phase factors and the normalizations are what you expect them to be. But you need to be careful there. So today, I'm going to use a simple domain, minus 1 to plus 1. And I'm going to use the Legendre polynomials because they are particularly simple. And they are just certain kinds of polynomials. And because I'm too lazy to implement them, I'm going to use a Julia package that is called Legendre polynomials. And then we don't actually need to define them ourselves. That is that. Yeah. Okay. So if we have, so say the basis functions are Legendre polynomials, and we have our coefficients, then we can evaluate the function everywhere. Now, you're going to need two other ingredients. The first ingredient is, what if we have the function? We want to know the coefficients. And the second is, if we have the basis coefficients, then we know the function, but we have a partial differential equation, so we need to calculate the derivative of the function. How do we calculate the derivative of the function if all we know is the coefficients? And I'm going to describe how to go from a function to coefficients first, because we're going to need that when we calculate the derivatives. Front goes up. So, have you done this before? Yes?
I was wondering, I forgot the name of the polynomial T.
The Chebyshev polynomials.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, Chebyshev was probably Russian. So if you take the Russian name and to turn it into English, it's spelled C-H-E-B-Y or something. But if you translate it into German, I mean, English and German use the same letters, we are different ways of translating names, then Chebyshev starts with T, T-C-H or something. And this is why people use T for the Chebyshev polynomials.
Okay.
Let's see whether we find it here. Whether there is a Chebyshev polynomials. Yeah, so this is how you spell Chebyshev in English, and in German there is a T-S-C-H or T-C-H in front of it as well. Hey, don't go. No, I think it's fine. Okay. Anyway, we are going to use the Legendre polynomials, so that's not that relevant. Okay, thanks. Can you increase the light level again? Sorry, thank you. Do you have another question? Okay. So, do you know how you go from a function to the coefficients?
In a product of the basis function.
Yes, yes, that's essentially what you do it. I don't know, are you all familiar with that? Let me just go through it once, maybe, so that no one is surprised. Okay, so what we have is that, I'm just going to write to copy that up here, f of x equals sum of I ci bi of x. And we have an inner product that, well, let's assume the inner product is just the integral over the domain. You can have another inner product. So let's calculate the inner product of this. This is a function with the basis function. And then we get integral f of x. Actually, let me write j here instead of I, with the basis function bi of x dx equals. So here we have a function on the left-hand side. And after integrating with bi, we have just a scalar. But we can do the integral with all the basis functions. So we have kind of many left-hand sides, one left-hand side for each basis function. So it's kind of the same information because we have infinitely many basis functions. And then here on the right-hand side, we have sum over j, cj, sorry, there's an integral, ej, x, bi of x dx. And on the left-hand side, we can't do much, but the right-hand side simplifies a lot. If you've seen this before, it's all straightforward because there's usually just one or two simplifications that you can do and you just do them. But if you haven't seen it before, can you make a guess how this simplifies? We can actually swap the integral and the sum. In particular, if we only have a finite n, it's a finite sum that commutes with an integral. Then we have an integral here, c, the coefficient does not depend on x, so we can pull it out of the integral. Then we get cj, and then we have integral bj bi. And this here, this term here, only depends on the basis functions. It doesn't depend on anything else, doesn't depend on f or the coefficients and so on. It's just a property of the basis functions. And this is usually called, for historic reasons, the mass matrix. M, let's call it Mij. And if the basis functions are orthogonal, which is, I want to assume, what does that mean for this matrix here? It means the matrix is diagonal. These being orthogonal means that this integral vanishes when I is not equal to j. So this is a diagonal matrix. And if they are orthonormal, then this is even the identity matrix. That is even much simpler. But I don't want to assume that, because in many cases that's not true. And having something that is not the identity matrix here isn't actually very difficult to handle, but this is usually a diagonal matrix. Well, it is a diagonal matrix if you have orthogonal polynomials. And of course, the diagonal entries here are just the inverses of the normalization factors that you have. In particular, in all the cases, Mij is going to be invertible. If it's diagonal, it's rather trivial, rather straightforward to do that. And if this is not diagonal, then it can be expensive. And if you use finite elements as a discretization method, for example, that's where the term mass matrix comes from, then you need to solve that. And if this is a sparse matrix, you remember linear algebra, everything I introduced 2 weeks ago, then of course this is also convenient to store that. And let's just, what else do we do? We assume it's diagonal. Okay, let me switch notation. Instead of writing the sum, I'm going to use the Einstein summation convention. You're familiar with that? Repeated indices, you don't need to write the sum. So this is then MijCj. And I wonder how I doof. Yeah. And then we can also just invert that. And then we also, I'm also going to rename the indices. No, let's make Cj equals 1 over m. Okay, this Einstein summation convention was a bad idea, because now I'm going to not use it. Mjj is just the j entry. And then we have this integral here. F of x, c, no, what, b. So there's no summation involved. I shouldn't have done that because of the diagonal matrix. This is just the jth entry. This is just the square of the jth basis function. So we project f, the function that we want to calculate, onto a basis function. We handle the normalization, and then we are done. This can be written in a different way. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that looks more familiar. This is b I f b I b I. So I'm using now the quantum mechanics notation for that dot product that we have here. And then we take our function f, we project it onto bi, and we divide by the square of that because it's diagonal. And this gives the coefficient. Oh, now I used a different name. Okay, now I called it ci. Same thing, different notation, same thing. I'm just using this notation for a dot product instead of the integral. Sometimes you define your dot product differently. Okay, do you have questions on that? Okay, seems clear. And now let's go to the other bit. This is the front, goes up. And now about derivatives. So we have a function represented into coefficients, and we want to calculate the derivative of the function. So the function f of x, and it is given as some coefficients, and we want to calculate the derivative. So let's do that. Then we get the gradient of f evaluated at x is the gradient of this whole expression. Again, gradient and the sum commute. Your coefficients, they do not depend on space. So the only thing that's left over is the gradient of the basis function evaluated at x. And we can now take this function and expand it in terms of the basis functions. That is, we take the gradient of the basis function and expand it in terms of the basis functions. Again, using the same expression up there, and then what comes out? I don't know whether I should write that explicitly or not. I'm not getting much feedback for you, whether you know that, whether it is boring or not. Anyway, it might not be surprising to you. No. Oof, okay. Might not be surprising, since the grading is a linear operator, that you can write this as, in abstract index notation, there's a abstract index notation. Sorry, I'm just trying to get the indices correct. It's not actually a complicated expression. Then you have D is a matrix that comes out, J, C, J. Is that confusing? That's probably confusing. I'm just trying to get... No, it's not confusing. I'm going to... When you expand this, you get a new set of coefficients, and the new set of coefficients are a linear combination of the old set of coefficients. So this is what you get here. So the gradient of f expanded in the set of basis functions is the old coefficients that you used before multiplied by a particular matrix. Maybe that was too much? Yes? No? Maybe? Does it make sense? Okay, I'm not getting any feedback, so I'm going to write a bit more detail here. Let's define this dij equals oh, I hope I get this right. So you take the gradient of the basis function and project it onto the basis functions, and that allows you to expand the gradient of the basis functions in terms of the basis functions. And if you do that, you get the new expansion. Okay, I have no idea whether this is trivial or way too complicated. Anyway, think about it. Derivative is a linear operator. If you so want, this is just representing function in terms of a basis. So if you apply a linear operator to the function, that means you can write that as applying a linear operator onto your basis coefficients. And if you write it out, that is then a matrix. So we apply a matrix on the basis coefficients. So to go from f to the gradient of f, you go from the coefficient C to coefficient C times a particular matrix. And I call this operator D because it's the derivative operator. And if you want to store some things constructively, if you want to represent a function in a computer code, of course you never write f of x because, there's no built-in way to handle a function. The only thing we store is this list of coefficients, C, it's a vector of coefficients. And then to take a derivative of a function, we apply this particular matrix that defines how a derivative looks like. Okay, maybe I should go through an example. Let me write down some... some functions. For example, we have a constant function and we have x. And does someone know what the second Legendre polynomial is, P2? It's something with x squared minus 1. Is that x squared minus 1? 2x squared minus 1?
2x.
And then the gradient of f, of course, is 0. And this is 1. And the gradient of this happens to be x. And if we expand this into coefficients, then how does this function look like in terms of coefficients? So in terms of coefficients, this function is just the first Legendre polynomial. So if we write in terms of coefficients, it's 1, 0, 0. And this function here, x, is just the p1, so it's 0, 1, 0. This is p0, p1, p2. And if we expand this function into Legendre polynomials, it's 0, 0, 1. And then if we expand the gradient of f into Legendre polynomials, how does that look like? This is zeros all over. And this function f is then 1, 0, 0. And this function is the derivative is 0, 1, 0. And then now we can write this as this times a particular matrix. So then we get that this matrix D the first row of D describes the derivative of P0. And the derivative of P0 is 0. So here we have zeros everywhere. And the second row of D describes the derivative of P1, the first Legendre polynomial, or the second, depending how you count it. And that means if you take a derivative, is that correct? No, I think I got the rows and columns wrong. Oh, I'm so sorry. This is probably more confusing. If you have a function, if you have a vector that is 1, 0, 0, that corresponds to a function that consists just of P0, just the first Legendre polynomial, you're multiplying with that matrix, the first column is all 0, so the result is 0. The derivative of the first Legendre polynomial is 0. And if you plug another function in here, 0, 1, that is the second Legendre polynomial, P1, and the derivative, the only non-zero column, row in that column is the first. So the derivative is then the first Legendre polynomial. Okay, that was not a good explanation. I am sorry. Somehow I am describing this in a very confusing manner. Okay, let me switch gears. Let me talk about how to do this in a computer code. And then I can give you more examples of how to calculate the derivative operator later on. And then maybe it becomes clearer. Okay. Okay. lots of flickering. And what's happening here? Something visible. Okay, the screen is all messed up. I do not like that. Okay, I hope you can see that. So I'm beginning my notebook by using this package Legendre polynomials. This is just the package that defines the Legendre polynomials. And I'm using WGL Machia just to be able to display something. And now I'm creating a figure. XS chooses the X coordinates where I want to plot something. For minus 1 to plus 1 in steps of 1 over 100, I'm creating a figure with a particular title. There are different Legendre polynomials that is usually labeled by N, by L, numbered by L. So I'm plotting Legendre polynomial 0 to 4. This is how you calculate a Legendre polynomial. PL is the name that they have. Calculating the Lth polynomial at x for all x in these positions. And then showing that figure. Of course, nothing happens here. I express my unhappiness. Okay, run all cells, kernel, please dot kernel and run all cells. I'm creating a plot of the first four Legendre polynomials so you get an idea of how they look like. You've probably seen that before. The first Legendre polynomial, P0, is just a constant. Here we go. Is that constant up here? The second one is a linear function. The P2 is this one here. Oh, I got it wrong. It's not 2, it's 3 over 2. Everything is getting more complicated. And then the third on the fourth are these. And the higher the order, the more maxima and minima they have. And one property they have, they all start at plus 1 or minus 1 at the left, they all end one at plus 1 on the right. And in the center, the higher L, the smaller the maxima get. That is, for very high L, they all stay very close. I mean, the y values don't get very large near the origin. And the difference to the Chebyshev polynomial is that the Chebyshev polynomials, all the maxima and minima are at plus 1 and at minus 1. They are thus a bit, I don't know, more elegant. This has advantages in certain cases. Now, let's take a particular function and expand it into Chebyshev polynomials. So to expand a function, we need to calculate these coefficients ci up to a particular n. Let's choose n equals 4. Why not? And let's calculate these. Yes?
So how large n should be? How do we tier the choice of n?
That depends on the problem. This is a property called convergence. What you typically do is that n needs to be large enough to capture. You see all the maxima and minima have a certain distance. So if n is too small, you can't capture any small features. And then if n is too large, then you don't gain much from it. And a typical value for n here would be between 10 or 30 or something. Although in a simple example, we could also go to 100 or so. I'm choosing n equals 4 because that's an easy thing to do. Okay. I have to describe something else before we do that, because to expand a function into Chebyshev polynomials, we need to evaluate that integral that I wrote up here. This is the integral of f with a basis function. And of course, f could be anything. We don't know what f is. Could be a sine function, something complicated. So to evaluate the integral over f, that's not a trivial task. We can't assume that we can do that symbolically. So one way to evaluate that integral to approximately would be to do something like Riemann sums or trapezoidal rule or something similar. And evaluating an integral and getting a single number out of it is called quadrature for historic reasons. And I'm going to point to a package today that is called cubature. Well, quadrature is kind of 2D in higher dimensions. You might call it cubature. This is a package called cubature that does that. It evaluates the function that you pass at various points. It sees how much error you might have. It tries finer grid spacing for Riemann sums, tries more elegant rules than just trapezoidal rule, and gives a particular approximation. So I'm not going to say much about that function, but one good package that does that is called H-cubature. That does multi-dimensional integrals. So you need to specify the bounds of the domain, which is assumed to be a hypercube, as a vector. And here, this notation in Juilliard is a vector with one element. You write not just 0, but 0, comma, and then nothing. It's a tuple with one element. You might have seen that notation in Python. It's super ugly and super useful. So I want to evaluate the sine function from 0 to pi. Since it's multidimensional, I need to convert the 0 into a vector. Oh, wait, actually, can I write it like this? Maybe I can write it like this. That would be nicer. Let me see that. And then to evaluate the sine function, the input x is a vector, kind of a tuple of all the coordinates, but my sine function is a scalar thing, so I just need to get the first thing out of it. So I say x of 1, and I'm evaluating it. And then let's see what h cubature says. If you evaluate, so we integrate the sine function from 0 to pi, the result is 2 and a bit. There's a small error in that integration, in that quadrature. And the estimated error is 10 to the minus 12, e minus 12. That's pretty good. Cubature has various options where you can choose the accuracy you want, and so on and so forth. But we are going to use cubature to actually evaluate that integral here. No, we need to evaluate these coefficients. I use a convention where if I store multiple things in a variable, I add an S to the variable name, so C's. These are all the C's, all the coefficients. You can use a different convention here. And to evaluate that, we need to evaluate this integral here between f and the basis functions for various I. Let's define f here. What is our f? What function do we want to project? Sine function, for example. Gaussian, what should we do? Let's sine 2 pi x. Sounds good. We're choosing n equals 4. That is, we want to calculate something here, and we want to do something here for I in 0 to 4. And now we need to evaluate this integral here. So h cubature, this is the integral. And we need to do the same trick here, because x here is a multidimensional thing, but f only expects a scalar. And what are the integration bounds here? We're using Legendre polynomials, and they are defined on a domain from minus 1. Plus 1. I didn't write that down, but that is important. Minus 1, 0, plus 1, 0. And we need to, not just f. What do we need to do here? We need to multiply f with the Legendre polynomial times pl of x, l. And this should give us the coefficients. Should get 5 coefficients out. L not defined. What is wrong? Oh, sorry. For L in 0 to n, not I. What is that now? Oh, cubature gives us 2 things. It returns both the result and the error. And we only want the error. Okay, let's define a helper function here. Sorry, it is too complicated. Integrate a function f from x0 to x1. That's x cubature. And then this looks much easier. F1x times PL of x. Then we don't need to, with all these idiosyncrasies of curvature. Good. So these are the coefficients. This is p0, the constant coefficient, which is 0. p1 is minus 0.38, and so on and so forth. Let's plot something. Let's plot both the original function and the function that we get here. So let's define a function fn. This is the sum of csi times pl. Sorry, what? So fn is the approximation that we have. It's the coefficients times the Legendre polynomial. And the Legendre polynomials are numbered from 0. In Julia, arrays start being indexed from 1. So to get the 0th coefficient, we look at zs of 1. This is where the plus 1 comes from. Now I want to plot something again. I'm just going to copy that script here. This is not Legendre polynomials, so I'll leave that out. And we want to plot two things here. We want to plot first the true solution, f of x, and the approximate solution. And then we see the difference. And then we have a sine. Oh, wow, that's a sine wave with two maxima and minima. That's a lot. Do we like that? Do we want to change that? Okay, I think I'm going to change it just pi, or maybe just sine of x, pi times x. Okay, so the blue thing is the actual sine function that we have. And the yellow thing is the approximation that we get here. And that is apparently the best approximation that we can get. Oh no, there's a bug in my code. Do you see it? What I implemented here is integrating the function f with the Legendre polynomials. But what I actually wrote down here is this additional term here that we don't have here. Do you see it? We are missing the normalization factor here. That is, what I implemented here is not actually this code. So we need to divide this by something else. Now, let's see what happens here. Oh, look at that. Look at that. Much better. The blue is the sine function, and yellow is the approximation. And you see the yellow function is sometimes below the sine function and sometimes above the sine function. And so the error is on average 0. If you calculate the L2 norm, this is actually the optimal representation in terms of the L2 norm. And of course, if we increase n, if we take more basis functions, we could improve that. So let me just do that. Let me go to n equals 8, for example. Recalculate your coefficients. We're getting more coefficients. And you see, the first coefficients are pretty large, but then the higher coefficients, they get smaller and smaller. That means they are less and less important. And that means that the contribution is smaller and smaller. What? Okay, I think the approximation is so good that we actually don't see the difference anymore. This is pretty surprising. I did not expect that. I think sine functions are, you know, the Taylor expansion of a sine function, you know, it has this 1 over n factorial term. And of course, in a plot, if the difference is less than 1%, you basically don't see it because, I mean, you have 100 pixels or something. So this is actually not a good example. So let's look at another function that is more difficult to approximate. Let's use as a Gaussian here. there's this exponential of minus x squared, the de Gaussian, is at a minus 2. And then let's see what happens here. Oh, really? Okay, let's make the Gaussian smaller. Then that is actually more difficult. So let's divide x by 20. Does it make it smaller? Then x needs to be larger? No, we multiply it here. I want to make it thinner. Then, let's use 0.2 here. Okay, you see a bit of an error when you approximate this Gaussian with Legendre polynomials. Okay, and now let's calculate a derivative of this function. This is the thing that I explained so badly on the blackboard earlier. So to calculate a derivative, what we want to do when we have a function given, we have given the function in terms of coefficients and in terms of basis functions. We know how to expand a function in terms of basis functions. Now, when we take a derivative of a function, we get derivatives of the basis functions. So we're going to expand the derivative of the basis functions in terms of the basis functions. It sounds a bit weird, but of course, derivatives of the basis function and basis functions are in principle independent. And before we do that, I want to clean up the code a bit more here. Let's define it. So this expression here expands a function in terms of basis functions, but everything is muddled together here. So let's make this cleaner. Let's call it expand f, n, expand a function f in terms of the first n basis functions. And I'm going to copy this expression here. Is that good? Does that work? That probably works. And then CS is expand F, N. Does it still work? Still works. So the Legendre polynomials package provides not just the Legendre polynomials, but also derivatives of the Legendre polynomials. So we don't need to evaluate the derivatives ourselves. For example, there is a, let's just plot them to see how they look like. I'm going to scroll up. These here are the Legendre polynomials, and we can similarly plot derivatives. Legendre polynomial derivatives, and I think you just add a D in front of it, you get the derivatives. No! Okay, I need to actually look at the documentation. Legendre polynomials. Go to the actual package. Scroll down. PL. DNPL. Oh, you can calculate the nth derivative. How convenient, in case you need that. DNPL. We only want the first derivative. And this is how they look like. So this zero line here is the derivative of the first Legendre polynomial, which is zero. The derivative of the linear is a constant function, and so on and so forth. And some of the derivatives become actually quite large near the domain boundary, which is why everything has been scaled from minus 10 to plus 10. So let's expand Legendre Let's do that. So we can call this function expand. We want to find the function, the DNPL of x, L, 1. expand, blah, 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 comma, n. Yeah, let's just do that. So if you expand the zeroth Legendre polynomial derivative, then we get all zeros. If we expand the first one, what's happening here? Hey. I don't like that. Okay. Kernel. Restart kernel and run all cells. Something's not working. Weird. Okay. Interrupt kernel. Maybe we can expand the next one. Does that work? Okay. I do not know what is wrong here. I apologize. Maybe I'm expecting too much accuracy, but this is really just expanding a polynomial in terms of another polynomial. That should not take that long. So what I'm trying to do here is calculate this matrix D. That explains us how to evaluate the derivative of the Legendre polynomials in terms of Legendre polynomials. And then once we have this matrix D, then every function is represented in terms of these coefficients C. And to calculate a derivative of that function, we just multiply this coefficient vector with the derivative matrix D. And I was going to calculate this derivative matrix D. And then if we have a partial differential equation and want to solve it, then we can directly translate it to something else. Since this does not work out and we just have a few minutes left, I'm not going to insist on that. I'm going to fix it and present it next time. But I'm going to briefly describe on the blackboard how it then looks. Let's assume we have a particular differential equation. For example, the Poisson equation. Laplace phi equals rho. Usually people put factors in front of it, but I'm doing it in 1D. And to translate that is the second derivative of a function phi is equal to some other function rho. So rho is usually given. There are also boundary conditions given. And phi is the one we are looking for. So phi is the thing that we would want to get expanded into polynomials. Well, I used to call that f earlier. Let's call it f here as well. And this is the second derivative of f. In one dimension, we can also write it as a double prime. So if we have f given in terms of coefficients c, and then this turns into the first derivative, another first derivative equals rho, dij, djk, kj equals rho I. So rho is given, rho is expanded into coefficients. I call them rho I here. And the function f is also represented into coefficients. I call them c. We don't know c. And then this expression, the second derivative of f, turns into an expression like this. These are all vectors. And then we can solve for k. Now here it doesn't work because we also need to incorporate the boundary conditions when we want to solve something. So we get some additional equations that encode how f looks at the boundary. But the idea is that you have a partial differential equation and you can translate it directly into an expression like this. And then once you have the c, then you can evaluate the function f everywhere. Okay. Okay, that concludes the lecture. Apologies for the technical problems here. Do you have questions? Today's tutorial will be about ordinary differential equations, essentially repeating what I showed yesterday in the lecture. And on Thursday, we will pick up here and we'll actually solve a partial differential equation. And well, we'll begin by calculating this matrix D. And if you have questions, if anything is confusing, apologies, feel free to ask questions. Thank you.